Hello, this is Out the Gate, the podcast about sailing and adventure on and around San Francisco Bay. Welcome. The Point San Pablo Yacht Club in Richmond is a haven for beautiful master mariner boats. You can walk down the dock there and there's one classic after another, most of them in pretty bristol condition. Front and center sits Luke Mayhew's 60-foot pinky schooner, Tiger, built in 1830. You can pick up the May issue of Latitude 38, and on page 78, you'll find a great profile of Luke by editor Tim Henry. Luke's a fascinating guy. He's a charter captain, a merchant marine, master mariner, and on top of all that, runs a small business making traditional rigging tools. The business is called Tiller and Gaff. For Luke, being on the water is about heritage, and specifically his heritage. His family on both sides were sailors, and he's carrying on that tradition in great fashion. Luke and I sat down aboard his boat with a couple of glasses of rum for a fun conversation about Tiger, tattoos, and trouble in San Pablo Bay. Enjoy. Thank you for having me aboard.
Cheers.
This is great. There's no way I'd rather spend a Friday afternoon than on a beautiful schooner. Let me first just have you start by introducing yourself.
My name's Luke Mayhew, and we're aboard the schooner Tiger. She was originally built in 1830, as is, exact dimensions.
She was used how?
She was a fishing boat. She was built in Essex, Massachusetts, and sailed out of Gloucester. She fished for mackerel and cod. It was hand-lined. She had two nesting dories, and she fished from about 1830 to 1875-ish. After about 1850, there was a massive decline in her output just because of the big schooners, the Gay Headers, the Blue Nose, the Mists of Avalon. So they kind of outfished the little pinkies.
This is called a pinky schooner.
It's a pinky schooner because she's pinked.
Which means what?
She's a double-ended with an outboard rudder.
Okay.
And she has bulwarks, and the bulwarks are pinked at the stern, so they're upturned. This is an old New England term. You get a pinky because it's pinked at the end.
What length of boat is this?
Overall, she's 60 foot.
Okay.
On deck, she's 53 or so. And in her period, it was the cat's meow. I mean, this was like the coolest boat to have for fishermen.
For what reason? Speed? Size?
Speed, maneuverability, options. I mean, shit, you got three sails. You got, you know, you can reef any number of them. These were the big boats going out. Small boats were the friendship sloops.
Okay.
These guys were noteworthy for their seakeeping, for their very heavy, stout, just plow. I mean, they're not fast or anything, but you know, I mean, they're slow as Christmas, but people felt safe and you could load them to the gills. That's important for a work boat.
You obviously have a love for older boats, for wooden boats, for the history. What is it about that that attracts you? What is it that just grabs you?
I wouldn't say it attracts me. It's a heritage of mine.
Yeah.
This is how I was raised. This is really all I know. I mean,
so it's, you know, it's more, it's just more who you are.
Right. And the passion that I get from doing this as I get older, you know, I kind of feel like I have to.
You said it's for you, it's your family history. Your father and your grandfather were both sailors?
Yeah, on both sides of my family. Yeah. They're all sailors.
Oh, wow.
My father is from the East Coast. My mother is from here. My mom was born in Alta Bates in Berkeley. She's an old school California kid. Her father, my grandfather McSweeney, came over with his brother Angus. They were both schoonermen. So my grandfather and my grandfather's brother would sail up and down the California coast in the lumber trade. And they would switch. Every season, my grandfather Ward would work the schooners. And while he was doing that, my great uncle would work the hillside. You know, he'd be a lumberjack. He'd fell trees. He'd work, you know, the mills. He'd work the sleuths, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. And then they would just switch.
Hmm.
And they would keep it fresh for them. And they did that for many, many years during the golden age of the California lumber trade until they ended up, you know, settling in to San Francisco and getting into all sorts of, you know, other shenanigans and stuff.
It sounds to me like this history of being at sea is really alive for you.
I mean, it's definitely like an ongoing conversation in the back of my mind. You know, it's like when Waterworld happens, I'll be set. You know? I'll be like, I'm good.
Well, we're getting there with global warming.
Yeah. But like, you know, and then on my father's side, they're all East Coasters, you know, so that game goes way back. They're all Irish fishermen that came out of Killybegs. When there was the Irish Troubles, they came over and fished in the East Coast.
I think it's really interesting you talking about your grandparents doing the your grandfather and great uncle doing the lumber, and then going to sea. Because you split your life some ways as well. Talk about that. You're a merchant marine, and you regularly go to sea that way.
Yeah. So before 2008. There was a lot of overseas shipping. And then 2008 happened, and we had that massive crash.
Right.
And everyone was up on the beach. And the guys that were really, like, in it, the lifers, you know, found a way. I mean, my license, I have an unlimited master's license.
Okay.
At the time, it was like a massive gut check where it was like, what are you doing fucking working a tugboat? You know, it's like, that's so low. But it was the only work that we could have. You know, we'd you know, sail to Vietnam, we sailed to the Med, you know, sail all over the world by just going down to the shipping hall and, you know, putting your card down and look at the board. I don't feel like Egypt today. You know, let's go down to the Philippines. Yeah, sweet. I'll take that one, you know.
But those days ended.
It was just like, whoop, close the book. And, you know, so a lot of us at that time, you know, really had to make a big choice. Because when we were shipping out in the hall, you know, doing the Merchant Marine thing or even the Union thing, it was like, you feel like working today? I still got some bucks left over. It's fine. I'll maybe next week. But on the domestic side, it was more, you know, like, okay, you take an interview, you get hired by a company, you get a boat, you get a relief. You get all these things, and you can set up a schedule and stuff. But at the same time, it was kind of, you know, it's kind of like you got to grow up a little. You know, it was less Peter Pan.
Right. You got to be there when you're supposed to be there. And yeah.
So going back to that kind of, you know, duality of my lifestyle, it was kind of a hidden blessing.
Okay.
You know, because at the time, you know, I was sailing and maintaining my traditional maritime heritage when I could, but then I'd go overseas for 3 months, and then I come back, and then, you know, there's always like a month of, you know, reconnecting with your people and then starting new conversations and then getting involved in a project, and then something got posted, I gotta go, you know.
Always being interrupted.
Yeah, and then checking out for another 3 to 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And
so having a little more continuity has allowed you to start Tiller and Gaff business.
Exactly.
Tell us about that.
For the last, I'd say, 8 years, I've been working the towed fleet. It's just offshore towing.
Okay.
Yeah, so I run a 250-foot tugboat, and we're towing about 120,000 barrels of oil. It's a tanker barge. Whether we're going to Hawaii or we're going to Southern California or all through the Aleutian Chain, all the way up to Red Dog, Barrow, Nome, Kotzebue, fucking Bethel. We go all over Alaska, everywhere, Inside Passage. It's a lot of fun. And it's just like going and going and going. And, you know, you get into this routine where like you get happy with your route, or you get your milk run, but you have a regular relief.
Mm-hmm.
So like when I'm at sea, Ryan's on the beach. When Ryan's working, I'm on the beach. And that is something that was so cool, and that really was what led to Tiller and Gaff becoming a reality. It's really helped to keep Tiger alive. Living, it's also helped with, you know, when we're making tools and
so let's talk a little bit more about what Tiller and Gaff is. So you charter Tiger as part of Tiller and Gaff.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to, you know, basically create a company that I could do what I normally do, but offer it to everyone else. There's the heritage, my craft, whether it's knotwork or woodworking, and a lot of it is tool-based. I basically took my father's and my grandfather's toolkits and made those tools and polished them a little bit, made them real pretty, but, you know, heaving mallets, serving mallets, all sorts of things that are very niche, very, like, traditional maritime heritage, you know, rigging tools.
Rigging tools that aren't available.
Right, and they're elsewhere. Not. I mean, you can kind of find them on, like, Toplich, which is, like, a Swedish thing, and paying an arm and a leg. But there's no one actually here in the States that are, you know, professionally making rigging tools.
So who are you finding that has interest in these tools?
I have a background in tall ships, sailing ships, and any of the people that have worked for me, you know, sailing on Picton or sailing on Europa or sailing on Endeavor or sailing on Chieftain or sailing on we're friends.
So those end up being your customers. They're
So
doing
like,
traditional rigging work on these beautiful boats all over the world.
Yeah, so there are brigantines and barks and full rig ships. There are schooners and there are all sorts of tall ships all over the world that I have friends in high and low places that are, you know, maybe they're the bosun or they're in the office. And, you know, I get a lot of orders from them because right now it's spring. So we're all gearing up for getting it up ready for the season.
Spring refit.
Yeah, uncocooning it and, you know. And then also, too, the spring and summer hire. So they're going to bring in a bunch of trainees, bring in a bunch of volunteers. They're going to bring in a bunch of crew. And I find that I get a number of orders so that the boats have in their bosun locker proper tools.
Tell me about learning your craft. Was it self-taught? How much of it was passed down to you?
I would say that it's 80% of living.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
being at sea.
Yeah, being at sea or just being a kid, you know, I mean, it's like you could ask the same question to a homeschooler, you know, it's, you know, how much of this were you self-taught? Well, I was like, well, it's just me and my parents, you know. It's like,
yeah, it's hard to know. It's hard to gauge yourself.
If you know how to hunt, how do you know how to hunt? Did you read a book? No, there's no fucking books about hunting. There's no YouTubes about, you know, cleaning a buck, you know.
Well, there probably are now.
Well, maybe, I guess. But
but yes.
Not when I was a kid.
Right.
There wasn't an internet when I was a kid, you know. Like, yeah. I remember the first dial-up, you know. No, all this stuff just comes from the heart. It just comes from a cellular level that was just so deeply ingrained in the way of life that, you know. And there was something so magical about the sea. And yeah, being offshore, that I wasn't one of those kids that was like, this is dad's thing, I'm going to do something else. It was more like, I get it.
When did you first get to do that? How young were you?
Oh, I don't know. I could sail a boat before I could ride a bicycle.
Yeah. Your dad parents took you out on the bay.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, We spent our early childhood kind of both places. So, like, my dad is from Mystic, Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
and my mom's from here. And so, all my dad's family are all like East Coast whalers and fishermen and lobstermen and same on my mother's side, where they're all, you know, lee shore sailors.
There was really no hope for you.
No, not at all. At all. So it was like, when we go, when we're home, we're sailing, we're on the water, we're you know, spearfishing or ab diving or, you know, surfing, skimboarding, whatever. And then when we go on vacation to, you know, to see my father's second half, well, they're too busy working. So if we want to spend time with them, we go to work with them, you know. So
out on the water.
Yeah. And it was always fishing or, you know, lobstering or it was chartering, you know. My Uncle Dick, you know, has a he's old now, but had a charter boat. And I kind of got this, you know, romantic idea of, that seems like cool. You know, it's like you talk to people. I mean, I'm a very social person. So, you know, you talk to people, you get to tell stories, you know, spin sea yarns that they'd have no idea what you're talking about. But, you know, they think you're cool because, you know, you got a great story. And, you know, at the end of the day, no one gets sick. Sunny day, you know, pretty, you know, you're just, you know, sharing.
You give them a good sea experience.
Yeah, and you're sharing heritage in like a very pleasant way, and not like a stuffy textbook way.
You got to recently take some kids out. I was reading about you took them out from Waldorf School. They were doing work at Spalding, and they were doing some other maritime. Oh, they went to the Bay Model,
mm-hmm.
and then you got to culminate with taking them out on Tiger.
Oh, it's great.
Tell me about that.
No, that was so amazing. The kids were, these kids were so engaged on such a physical level. They just gobbled it all up. We had 2 days to sail around. Of course, you know, it was school. So
yeah.
I worked with their teachers. There were 3 teachers that came along with us. We did some science stuff. We did some mathematics stuff, navigation stuff. And what was even cooler was it was a perfect weekend.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it was like I sailed over to China Camp on like Friday and dropped the hook and then got my skiff out. We got a little, I'm very, very dear friends with China Camp and everyone that works there and, you know, and the whole vibe there. So my good friend John Muir, he put his skiff in and, you know, we use the little power skiff to shuttle people from the dock, because it's really, you know, there's an anchorage and then there's, you know, the beach, and it's, you can walk, you know. So we had that great, you know, friendship, you know, going. But yeah, I taught them how to sail on and off the hook. And we got out there and it was blowing maybe 16 to 20 knots, which is really where Tiger kind of just lays down and stays put. And it's all San Pablo Bay, so, you know, there's no swell, there's no chop, there's no nothing. It's, you know, the only thing that you got working against you is the tide.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we were just flying, you know, just 12 knots to East Brothers, 10 knots back, and just buzz, 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 buzz. You know, and for me, it was just like, oh, God, you know, we got to turn around again. And, oh, God, we got to turn around again. And then the kids are, you know, they don't know what's going on. You know, they don't quite get it. I mean, some of them, by the second day, they were, you know, figured out, oh, we're moving, you know.
Now, you fit 12 kids down below here.
Up and above.
That's nice. Oh, that's great.
But it was, you know, this is one of those boats where, you know, it was like, by the second day, with the rails buried in the water, there were like 6 to 8 kids just snoring.
You wore them out.
It's like, you know, it's like on this kind of boat, there's nothing that happens fast.
Yeah.
You know, and you settle in, you dig in, and you're just there. You know, it's whatever. It's kind of boring to sail this kind. You know, it's not a race boat. It's a work boat. You know, she's heavy and...
That's great, though. It's hands-on. You know, the kids, I'm sure, were there doing it.
But it was, you know, and then there's no winches on board, so they actually got to bring in the sheets. They got to action, you know, maybe 2 or 3 people need to do it, and it gets people involved, and then once it's done, set, sails herself, you know. So that was really an awesome experience that we've done several times.
Part of your tie to historical sailing and the art of sailing is tattoos. So I can't finish this conversation without asking you about your tattoos. I can see the pig and the chicken on your feet. Tell us about that tradition. What do they signify?
my cock and boar.
Yeah, cock and boar.
When I was a kid, my father's covered in, you know, crazy tattoos, and all my uncles, you know, I mean, it's just like, it's a sailor thing, right?
Right.
It's just part of the culture. It's just part of, you know, earning your rights. You know, for me, tattooing has never been like, that's a really cool picture, and then I just like smear it all over my chest.
Yeah.
It's always been about achievements, and in my inner circles, it makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Especially offshore, especially, you know, sailing deep sea, you know, when you're, I mean, you know, I'm not an old captain, I'm a young captain. And, you know, when you walk on a deck, you know, you want your crew to just be quiet. Just like, no, I don't want to deal with you guys. I'm here to do a job. I'm here to sail this ship. I got enough to deal with.
You need that respect.
And it's one of those last industries, you know, second to none of being in jail. Like, you know, like, you can paint your body and people will just look away. They'll be like, well, okay. And that draws from a lot of respect, and it also draws from a lot of pride, and it, you know, boost me up, you know, when I step on a deck of a new tanker or a new container ship and people see that and they're instantly like, then that's one less thing that I got to deal with because I got to sail this boat. You know, I've never been on this ship and I got to figure out its maneuverability, its turning circle, and sail it within 4 hours, you know. Or on a sailing ship, the same thing. It's like, I got to figure out the sail plan and I got to figure out the watch plan. You know, where's the foredeck crew? Where's the midship crew? Where's the aft deck crew? How many sails are they willing to run? How many sales can I work with? So tattooing has always been a very important part of this culture of sailing, but it's also kind of cool. It's kind of punk rock.
But back to the
back to my feet.
Your feet. Because we got a lot to cover. We got a lot of tattoos to cover.
I got a lot of tattoos, and I got some crazy stories that are all over my backside. But my feet were my mother's fault, actually. When I was 16 years old, I was working the docks in San Francisco. I was working during the day at Hyde Street Pier, working on doing rigging work and on Balclutha and Thayer and Alma and all those boats, you know, kind of honing my craft, honing my skill of, you know, seizings and splicings and, you know, all this, you know, rig theory and, you know, fair leading and all this other crazy stuff. But at night, I was working, and I worked at Lyle Tuttle's tattoo shop. And Lyle Tuttle he's a god. There are three grandfathers of Pacific tattooing, and it's Lyle Tuttle, Ed Hardy, and Sailor Jerry. And they're all contemporaries, they're all friends, and I, you know, just for whatever reason, got an opportunity to work with Lyle. It may or may not have anything to do with that his shop was, you know, four blocks up the street from the docks, but, you know, whatever.
Had to wander by it every day.
But I worked for him for a number of years when he was still tattooing at the shop.
Wow.
He taught me how to tattoo. I worked there for a while, and then when I got my first overseas gig, I was 18. Yeah, I'd worked in the shop for about 2 years, and when I was 18, I went up to the hall, put in my Z card. I got a ship the next day, or for the next day, to Kobe, Japan. Told my mom. And she's like, what? You really? Like, 2 years have gone by and you didn't do anything to prepare for this inevitability? Like, what the fuck's the matter with you? You know? I was like, oh, I was crushed. I was like, oh man, I totally fucked this up. Because, you know, she's an old Irish, you know, gypsy, and there's a lot to be said with juju. And so the next day, when I went to work to tell him, like, oh, hey, by the way, the day after tomorrow, I'm shipping out for Kobe, and, you know, and I'll be back in, like, maybe 4 months, you know, probably 90 days at least. It was also accompanied by, oh, and by the way, my mom's pissed off that I don't have any, you know, like, omens to keep me safe. So thanks for 2 years of service. Get to work.
Before I go.
So, yeah.
I need some tattoos on my feet.
So Lyle did these. These are Lyle Tuttle originals.
Wow.
Of the cock and boar.
And for those who don't know, what do they signify?
So,
what is the omen?
Okay, so
that your mom needed you to have before you set off.
So, like, in the age of sail,
yeah.
These were very popular tattoos because, you know, they started to get really popular during the Napoleonic era, right? And they were very popular within the English naval fleet because back then, the most common survivors of shipwrecks, flounderings, naval engagements were the pigs and the cocks.
Got it.
Because, you know, the sailors would just fight until the end, or they'd get dragged down by the cargo. But the pigs, they're too fat. All they got to do is float, you know. And the cocks were too cocky because, you know, they don't want to get their feathers wet. So they always find something to float on.
So these are supposed to keep you safe, keep you from drowning.
And so originally sailors would put those omens, those tokens, on their lowest part of their body.
Ah.
So as long as these guys are staying high and dry, the rest of me probably will be.
That's great.
Yeah, so Lyle, he tattooed a bunch of rough decking.
Oh, yep.
Broken decking that they're dancing on, and they're all
going up into the stars there.
Yeah, looking up at the sky. So That's great. So they're not chasing bubbles, they're chasing stars.
Did that please your mother?
Oh yeah, yeah. So that was all she needed. That was one of my early tattoos, but most of the other ones are like milestone tattoos, where like you do something, you get something. You do something, you get something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the one you're proudest of?
I've got a number of ones that I'm like proud of. I have a shell backing tattoo.
Yeah, from crossing.
Right, from crossing the equator. And then my first port of call, the first time I crossed the equator, was Tahiti. When I sailed into Papeete, I was invited by the native tribe to go to Morea. I was like, what does that mean? I have some shore leave. And I go to the elder, and he's like, oh, yeah. Go to Morea. I'm like, how am I supposed to fucking get... Morea is an island off, right, you know.
Right, yeah.
Offshore. And I'm like, how the fuck am I supposed to get out there? You know? He's pointing to me at this outrigger canoe, like, oh, fuck. And I, you know, at the time I was like kind of pissing myself, but then I, you know, I remembered, oh, fuck, whatever. I've been at sea for like 36 days and I'm going to go into town, get a bottle of rum, and I'll feel a lot better about it pretty soon.
I'll relax after that.
So I got my bottle of rum and I came back. There was a canoe with a paddle, and then there were like 8 bros just fucking beefed out in their outriggers waiting for me. And I was like, oh, fuck. I totally dropped. I like totally ruined this whole thing. And they're like, and you know, and that was the coolest thing.
So you rode.
Yeah. Morea. So we paddled to Morea, and these were like little outrigger canoes. Okay. So
singles, or were you on your own in a?
Yeah, singles. Yeah, it was all singles. When I found out eventually, but they were surfing canoes. Yeah, so you don't put your feet in it. Right. You kind of straddle the thing, but the trades are consistent. So the waves are consistent. Mm. And so as long as you have at least shoulder high, so like 4 feet waves, you don't need to paddle much. You just surf.
Nice.
Yeah, so you get off shore of Papeete, you go north until... You know,
and then the trades.
Yeah, and then you catch in, and then you're basically just steering. You know, your paddle is more of a steering oar. And I totally learned this just from watching the 8 guys ahead of me. And they were like, you know.
Keep up.
Like, they didn't speak English. It was one of those events where it was like, fuck, at least I got a bottle of rum. You know?
Yeah. And like, what was the tattoo that they came out of that?
Yeah, so anyway.
That sounds like an amazing experience.
So we ran out there, and then I told them the whole story of Anglo shellbacking, what that means, and, you know, and the story behind that. And then, yeah, and then so they brought me to the hut, the grass house, and yeah, we tattooed a massive turtle on my leg, and it was all traditional. It was all boar's tooth tattoo with a hammer and the.
Now, how does that compare in terms of pain to what you got at Lyle's shop?
Dude, it sucked. Fuck, you kidding me? I was like, I keep saying this, but I was young then. I was
Did you still have the bottle of rum?
No. That was well wasted. I was just sitting there steering, you know.
Oh, man.
No, that was well gone. No, it was different. It was like you could feel every, you know, bang, 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 bang. And, you know, I've got a bunch of other crazy tattoos where they're all tribal style and stuff. But this one was definitely kind of the worst because there's an actual hammer that's whacking into you. And the whole time I was like so stoked. I was like, yes, this is so badass. This is going to be a great story. I'm gonna like, it hurts so much, but fuck, whatever. I bet you it's going to like get all like scarry and like, it's going to look gnarly and blah, blah, blah. Nah. Now, at the end of it, 2 hours later, it's this little teeny, little cute little Tahitian turtle.
But you do have a good story out of it.
And the other thing was like, you know, I was like, oh, fuck it, whatever. It's gonna get all gnarly and scarly. No, it's honestly one of the cleaner tattoos.
They know what they're doing.
Oh, fuck, man. I mean,
been doing it for
generations. Yep.
What else do you want to talk about that we haven't mentioned?
When I was a young boy, maybe 12, 13, my brother and I have an Irish twin. We used to sail out of the Richmond Yacht Club.
Okay.
And we thought it was just the coolest thing, right? You know, because like we grew up sailing, we knew everything about sailing. We were just kids, and you know, fuck these idiots. They don't know nothing, you know.
Right.
And but at the same time, like Dad was nowhere around. We could just be badasses, and
you know, had each other to support. Right. Yeah.
And that kind of got to our heads one night. It was after a big regatta. They don't do it anymore, but there used to be a Brooks Island race.
Okay.
It was basically just sail around Brooks Island. Inevitably, half of the kids would run aground.
Sure.
You know, on the backside. So shallow. Yeah. Because if they weren't, like, on it, if you know, the timing was always set where it was like you came in with the flood and then you'd go out with the ebb and blah, blah, blah. But if you were, like, dicking around over, you know, anywhere, you'd be on the mud, and then the little jolly boat would go, should have paid attention. But it was like after one of those races, obviously we won, and you know, we were sitting in the clubhouse having our Shirley Temples, feeling badass. And at the time, you know, my parents worked. So we were just going to sit in the clubhouse until, you know, we ate like 3 cheeseburgers and, just rolled around. No, Leo and I, you know, got angsty, and we took our little FJ out when no one was looking.
Okay.
And this was pretty much the first of the flood. You know, we were just going to go, I don't know. Leo had like a flare. We were just going to go out to Red Rock and then set off a flare and then, you know, funny. No. We got flushed out of the toilet. We couldn't keep it up.
You found yourself where?
In China Camp.
Ah.
That was the first time I went to China Camp. I was 12 years old. I had my brother. It was an open boat. You know, we worked our asses off. By the time we were under the bridge, we were like, we're screwed.
Yeah.
But by the time we got to East Brothers Lighthouse, we kind of figured it out. Kind of figured out like the flow and how much wind there was, and you know, we could kind of keep up with it. And then we cut all the way across and almost hit the sisters.
Mm-hmm.
But we got washed out, and then we got sucked into that, you know, shrimping eddy that took us right into China Camp. And that was the first time I met Frank, and he came out, you know, he's like, what the fuck? I mean, Frank was a young man at that time.
This was Frank who lived at
Frank Kwan. Yeah.
Frank Kwan. He was the last.
He was the last living survivor, of the China camps. And we've been best friends since.
Wow.
Yeah. This is back in the day, right? I mean, there wasn't a hard line in China camp back then. So we drifted up, got on the beach, freezing cold, you know, shiver, shake. We were just kids, right?
You're wet at this point.
Soaking wet in this open FJ, right? And Frank just came down from his house laughing at us. You fucking idiots. Like, where the hell did you come from? And I couldn't even hold on to anything. And Frank grabbed the boat and brought it right up the beach, took down the sail for us. And Leo and I were just like looking at the boat like, oh, I don't want to go back. And then Frank's like, come on. Frank took us up to the house, poured us all some scotch, some Cutty Sark scotch. I remember that vividly. Had a couple of those. We all had a couple of those. And then Frank's like, all right, get in the truck. You know, so we all piled in the truck. Frank had a big, giant golden retriever at the time. The retriever gets the passenger seat. And then Leo and I got in the bed of the truck. And then, so, you know, and it's kind of, it was a bumpy road back then, but it was, you know, it was just as exciting driving from China camp to San Rafael in the back of his fucking flatbed as it was sailing the whole way. He took us to the nearest payphone and we borrowed 25 cents from Frank and called my dad, and he wasn't home, so we left a message. So we went back to Frank's house, and
I love it.
Yeah, we spent the whole weekend with Frank. But you know, I mean, daily we'd go back and pay phone, try and get a hold of my dad, and then when I finally did, he was like, "Well, how's the boat? Is the boat okay?"
Not how are my sons. He has his priorities right. Is the boat all right?
Is the boat okay? Okay, well, bring the boat back. Okay.
So you fight your way upwind, hopefully on an
ebb.
On an ebb.
It was totally the ebb. We waited. We left. We anchored the boat off of the shelf, and then we waited till it started to drift south, and you know, then we hopped aboard. But that was how I met Frank.
That's awesome. And that's, you know, only the beginning of your sailing adventures.
No, no, I mean, we were know-it-alls by then. Yeah, yeah,
that's right. That's what gets you in trouble.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great story. There's so many other things I think we can talk. We'll have to have another conversation. We'll talk about Celestial and shanties and, you know, things we touched on briefly before we even started recording. But we'll have to save that for another time.
Yeah, no, totally. I look forward to it. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Luke.
Yeah.
If you want to see pictures of Luke and learn more about his boat, his business, and his philosophy, pick up a copy of the latest Latitude 38 magazine, and you'll find Tim Henry's profile on page 78. If you enjoy the Out the Gate podcast, tell your friends about it and leave a review on iTunes. You can always email me too at outthegatesailing@gmail.com. That's outthegatesailing, all one word, @gmail.com. I'm Ben Shaw, host and producer of the show. Thanks, as always, for listening.